For years, Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Through deeply reported, narrative-driven stories, we're digging into the myths, scandals, and power structures that still shape the South, and in a lot of ways, the country itself. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, an Odyssey podcast, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.
It is 6:08 in the Twin Cities. Great to be with you on a Saturday night for this holiday weekend, along with Sloan Martin in our newsroom, and also the one and only Jonathan Lowe at the controls here at News Radio 830 WCCO. We have an awesome show lined up for you for this holiday weekend. We're starting with, in just a few minutes, we're going to hear from somebody who is making news right now, Secretary of State Steve Simon. You actually heard the President of the United States criticizing officials from a number of states who are saying they will not give out personal voter information to the commission, the presidential commission that is looking at alleged voter fraud. The president criticizing those officials in many states. Obviously, he's criticizing Secretary of State Steve Simon because Steve Simon said today he is not going to give out personal information from every single voter in the state of Minnesota. I didn't realize that the Secretary of State's office, and I suppose I should have thought of this, has the information on where I lived, what elections I've voted on, what primaries I've voted in, even the last four digits of my Social Security number. The Trump administration has asked all of that, for all of that information from secretaries of state all over this country, all 50 states, a number of them, including Minnesota. Secretary of State Steve Simon is saying no. We'll also ask him about allegations that the Russians may have hacked into numerous states' election systems during the 2016 presidential race. And we're also going to talk later this hour with an attorney about the new workplace rules in Minneapolis with this $15 an hour minimum wage and also the new sick time policies. And think about it. Maybe your company is based in St. Louis Park, but maybe you spend a lot of time working in Minneapolis. How does that affect you? And is this something that is going to spread to other communities? Very important. We got a lot going on here. My friend David Schultz is actually on vacation, well-deserved. So we're going to, in the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to kind of break it up, do something a little bit different, talking about cyber attacks in general, but also in the 8 o'clock hour, we are number one, folks. You know how Minnesota's always number one in a lot of lists? Well, did you catch this? We're number one for the fattest pets. So seriously, think about that. And I think it's because we spoil our pets. But anyway, we're going to talk to a veterinarian about that and why that is a source of concern. But let's take a quick break and see if we can get right on with Secretary of State Steve Simon, who has been a very busy guy the past. A lot going on in the news, folks. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. A lot has been going on, obviously, with the president. A lot of controversy over his tweets and his feud with the hosts of Morning Joe. But there is a very important story. You heard it at the top of the hour from CBS News. The president pushing back on the leaders of some 20 states, election officials, saying they will not comply with a White House commission sweeping request for personal and public data from the nation's 200 million voters. Both Republican secretaries of state and Democratic secretaries of state are amongst those who are objecting to this. Joining me right now is the top election official in the state of Minnesota, Secretary of State Steve Simon, who is among those election officials saying no to this White House commission that he is not going to release personal information from Minnesota voters that the Secretary of State has. Secretary of State Steve Simon, thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Let me ask you, when did this first come up? I mean, did you know this was coming?
No. The first inkling that I had about this letter was late on Wednesday evening. And not even that I got it. I heard from a couple other secretaries from other states saying, hey, we just got this letter in. Seems like the kind of thing you're likely to get. So okay. Then Thursday morning.
So you get the letter.
Yeah, we got the letter Thursday morning.
And what did the letter ask, Secretary Simon?
Well, the letter was sweeping. broad. The letter asked for a number of different categories of information on every single registered voter in Minnesota. That's nearly 4 million. It asked for things as simple as name and address, but as intrusive, in my mind at least, as Social Security number information or military service record or voting history or whether they had lived or voted in another state before. This is personal information, and you know, my first thought is when people in Minnesota registered to vote, I don't think they ever intended or thought that their personal information would end up in some federal database, which looks like what they're trying to construct. So that gave me great pause, and so I talked about it with a lot of people, didn't sort of go off on a knee-jerk decision, talked about it with a lot of people, lawyers, others, and came to the conclusion on Friday that this was not something that we were going to comply with. It was a request. I just want to make that clear to your listeners. This was not a subpoena. This was not an order from a court. It was an invitation to provide this information, and I decided to decline that invitation.
All right. Well, this is still from a White House commission, and this White House commission is tasked with looking into the president, as I understand it, the president's allegation that 2 to 3, even million people voted illegally in 2016. And that has been debunked by not just Democrats, but Republicans as well. Is that your understanding of what this commission is supposed to do?
Yeah, that is my understanding. And that's another thing that really caused me great concern, which is what are these folks planning on doing with this information? Is it all in service of kind of justifying this theory about millions of people voting illegally, or is it something else? I'd really want to know that. And there's nothing about what they're doing that's transparent here. And the other thing I would say that I find deeply concerning is that the co-chairs of this commission are two people, Vice President Pence and the Secretary of State of Kansas, who have very strong opinions about not only that allegation, which they agree with, but other aspects of our election system. And by the way, they're entitled to it. They're able and they are articulate people. I happen to disagree with them, but there's nothing wrong with them having a strong opinion. But I would say having that strong, longstanding opinion make them very objective. And so this inquiry just doesn't have, to me, the ring of something that's going to be very fair or very balanced.
And you're certainly not alone, Secretary Simon. At least 20 states, secretaries of state, election officials from 20 states, some of them Republicans, have said no. I think the Mississippi Secretary of State has been quoted a great deal saying, and he's a Republican, saying that this commission can jump in the Gulf of Mexico, and Mississippi is a great launching point for the Gulf of Mexico because, of course, they border the Gulf of Mexico. Let me ask you this. I guess when I first saw this story, I guess I thought, well, I guess I was a little surprised that, and I forgive me for saying this, but I was surprised that you had some of this information. And then I thought, well, obviously the Secretary of State would have your name and your address because that's how they decide where you vote. I just don't remember ever registering with my Social Security number. Am I just forgetting things, which is certainly possible?
You're not at all forgetting things. Most people register with a driver's license number, but you are given the option of registering either with a driver's license or with the last four digits of your Social Security number, because some people don't have driver's licenses. So no, it's not at all. I mean, I'm sure you probably did register with your driver's license, as did I, but that's still an option. So even the Social
Security... Do they want that information?
Yes, they wanted
your driver's license information?
Well, they wanted identifying information, which could include that kind of stuff. But what was most alarming to me was the explicit request for Social Security numbers. Now, we wouldn't have that on every voter, but we'd have that on a great number of them.
And the entire Social Security number?
No, it's the in Minnesota, at least, it's the last four digits.
I think that a lot of people listening here are probably going to be very grateful for you doing that. I mean, I don't think there's one person out there who has not been somehow involved in some kind of identity theft or you know, fraud or whatever. I mean, I personally was in a tough situation with my Social Security number was actually compromised. And I just think people are really worried about this right now. Let me ask you also about the records of those serving in the military. Is that because some people who serve in the military are able to vote absentee as well they should? And so the record of their military service would be, you know, something that you might have?
Yes, correct. That's exactly right. There's a whole class of voters under federal law and state law who are military and overseas voters. They are folks who maybe are stationed abroad, but Minnesota is their home base, so to speak, for voting purposes. Even though they might not have been here for a couple or even a few years, this is the state from which they went into the service. And even if they're in Afghanistan or Kuwait or elsewhere, this is where they vote, and we would have that record. And it just seemed to me, again, that this is one of those sensitive areas. I'm just not sure why they want this information. And even if I knew more about why they wanted it, I just don't think Minnesotans expect, when they register to vote and do their civic duty, that this stuff is going to end up in Washington, D.C. in a cobbled-together state-by-state attempt to build a federal database, which is sure what this looks like to me.
Right. And all right, so have you, Secretary Simon, have you did you write the White House back or this commission back?
Well, we haven't. July 14th was the requested date by which to respond by letter. I've announced what I'm going to say, but I haven't drafted the letter yet. I'll get it in by July 14th. I'll do them the courtesy of that, and I'll formally respond and perhaps explain some of my rationale. But I will do that, but I haven't done that yet.
Right. And you have no idea, and it sounds like these other secretaries of state have no idea what this database is going to be used for.
No, I don't. You know, the commission is not even going to meet for the first time until July 19th. So it's kind of speculation. I do have a hunch about what they might do with it. It has to do with Secretary Kobach. He's the Kansas Secretary of State, who's the co-chair, along with Vice President Pence. And he has a database that he likes to use in Kansas, and it has invited other states to add to, which purports to find, undocumented immigrants and others to vote. The problem is, it's a very flawed model. It tags a lot of people who are eligible voters as ineligible, and there are a lot of inaccuracies. Anyway, that's my suspicion.
Right.
I don't know that. July 19th is the first meeting, but since he has pioneered this particular screening device, which again has been criticized for its inaccuracies, I think that's the kind of thing it looks like he might want to try, but I just don't know. I'm speculating.
Right. Well, I think, you know, I the first time I saw it, I just thought this just seems, as I said, so many people's, you know, identities and information has been compromised to such a degree, and this really is a bipartisan response. So you're going to be working on a letter and a response to the president's request. So we will definitely continue to follow that and you know, keep up with you on that. Let me ask you another thing that's been in the news recently is that in all these hearings with all this investigation into Russian hacking, it has been made public that 21 states across this country did, in fact, the Russians made attempts to compromise or hack into 21 individual states because the voting is by state. You're person in charge of that. Was Minnesota in any way compromised, or do you have any evidence that they tried to get into Minnesota's databases?
Yeah, we have no evidence that Minnesota was a target or that Minnesota was infiltrated. And there are a couple of layers to my answer. One is that our own cybersecurity efforts, which were greatly enhanced the last couple of years, determined no such infiltration. We work with the Department of Homeland Security. They would have notified us by now and would have notified local elections administrators had they been on that list of 21 states. And we've asked them, hey, are we on the list? And they said, well, unless you've been notified or the locals have been notified, you're not. And we haven't been. So not only did we independently not find it, but Department of Homeland Security has not given us that phone call saying that they found it. So we're quite confident that we were not among the 21 states.
And the testimony before Congress was said that about those 21 states where the attempts were made is that there's no evidence that any votes were changed. Going back to this notion, you know, when people hear the president of the United States say he believes that voter fraud is widespread in this country, 2 to 3 million fraudulent votes, the individual states, I mean, how much control, I mean, it's completely by state, isn't it, that we vote?
Yeah, it is. And even within states, I can't speak for other states, but in Minnesota, it would be really, really hard to pull something like that out. I mean, to use President Trump's number, our pro rata share in Minnesota of the numbers that he's talking about, say 3 million, for example, would be something like 60-some thousand fraudulent votes, which you and your colleagues in the media would rightly have, you know, screaming headlines. If that were the case, that would be total corruption, and that's just not the case here at all. And so we in Minnesota have a decentralized system when it comes to the vote counting. So we in our office do not count votes. That happens at the local level in nearly 4,000 different precincts and polling places across Minnesota, which is a great system when it comes to vote tabulation, because if there was some mastermind out there trying to switch numbers around, it would take a lot of people in a lot of places. You know, we have 32,000 election judges. That's what it takes to run an election in this state. That's a small army. And as you know from your own polling place, I'm sure, or your listeners do, I mean, those are the people you know. You see the same people year in and year out. They do it as a civic duty.
Absolutely.
And you know, a lot of people would have to be in on it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Do you have a figure for how many people voted in 2016 who shouldn't have voted, whether they were convicted felons or didn't have the right address?
Yes.
In Minnesota.
In Minnesota. Here's what I can say. State law requires that our prosecutors, our county attorney, report to us all over Minnesota. They have to report to us within 15 days of completing an investigation. So even before they charge, even before they prosecute and convict, just completing an investigation of possible misconduct, they have to report to us. And as of this phone call, that number is 9 counties for a total of 16 people. Now, that's 16 too many. I'd love it to be 0. We're always aiming for 0. But you got to put that into some perspective. We had nearly 3 million voters. So the fraction is 16 over nearly 3 million. That is excellent. That is as close to 0 statistically as you can get. And you know, we're always striving for 0, but 16, and that's not even convictions. That's just concluded investigations, which may or may not result in a conviction.
And just out of, I mean, that's a tiny, I'm not that good enough at math. It's like 0.000, you know, 1%. But what, and in most of those cases, were they felons?
Yeah, most of them were.
Who thought they could vote, but could. Okay.
Exactly.
All right. And we did have a question via text here for you, sort of going back to that first issue, this request by the President's Commission. You said that you took a great deal of time to kind of go over this and look at this. Did you consult at all with the Minnesota Attorney General's office or get any legal opinions about this?
No, I not with the Minnesota Attorney General's office, but we have
probably your own lawyers
city with our internally. So we have lawyers within our office, but not with the Attorney General's office, no.
Okay. And, you know, one of the President has been responding sort of all day on this. One of the things he said is, what do they have to hide? What's your response to that, sir?
You know, I understand that. I'm not so sure that that's the best argument for President Trump to be making, given some of the inquiries into things like tax returns. I mean, you can sort of flip that around pretty easily. You know, what do you have to hide by not producing X, Y, and Z? It's nothing to hide, except it's something to protect, which is people's private information. I'm all for anyone doing a really honest sort of inquiry in how we can make our system better in Minnesota or elsewhere. Absolutely. But I am quite nervous and suspicious about this particular commission and about the scope and the breadth of the information that they're seeking. So it's not about hiding anything. It's about protecting nearly 4 million Minnesotans who have every reasonable expectation that when they register to vote, their stuff is not going to end up in some database for some purpose that we don't even understand. So that's how I would answer that.
And you know, this is obviously, and we appreciate your time this holiday weekend, this is obviously the beginning of a holiday weekend. So far, we're hearing from at least 20 states that are not going to do that. I mean, that's a large number of states, and we don't know if that number is going to grow as more and more people such as yourself, people who are in charge of state election systems, are saying, no, we're not going to do this. We're not going to be a part of it. It'll be interesting to see how that happens and also what happens with the president's pushback. But I do want to thank you. And I think a lot of people, this certainly has caught a lot of people's attention. Secretary of State Steve Simon, thank you so much. And I want to say goodbye to you. If you could just spend a second talking to our studio coordinator, Jonathan Lowe. We want to make sure we can reach you next week in case there are any developments on this story. Obviously, you have until the 14th, which is obviously not this coming week, but the next week, to write a response to the president, and want to write it in a pretty detailed fashion.
I think so. Detailed enough so that I'm explaining myself and explaining our position.
All right. Well, Secretary of State Steve Simon, thank you so much. And Jonathan will just make sure we have your right contact information. Always a pleasure. Secretary of State Steve Simon, folks, one of those election leaders across the country who's saying they will not comply with this commission's request for personal information on 4 million Minnesota voters. It includes your name, your address, your voting history, where you voted, when you voted, perhaps even parts of your Social Security number, perhaps even your military records. The secretary is saying that he plans to work and respond to the president's commission's request with a no. And as I said, he is not alone. There are a number of states, at least 20 so far, that are saying they will do just that. All right, folks, we are going to take a break. We're going to give you some holiday weather forecast. There's good news for tomorrow. And we also want to, in the next half hour, visit with an attorney about some of the new workplace rules having to do with wages and also sick time, what you need to know. So keep it here at News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is 6:34 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock, along with studio coordinator Jonathan Lowe. Well, this half hour, we're going to talk about some new workplace rules in the city of Minneapolis, also, I believe, in the city of St. Paul, and also that new $15 an hour wage. What does that mean? What does it mean if you are working for a company that is based in St. Louis Park, but they've got an office here in Minneapolis? Are you affected? We're going to sort through all of that with Lisa Schmidt. She is an attorney at Nyland, Johnson & Lewis. Lisa, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me, Esme.
All right, let me ask you, before we get to the $15 an hour wage issue, let me ask you about the sick leave and general leave policies that were passed by Minneapolis and St. Paul. What do those say, and how does that affect people who might work in Minneapolis, but maybe their company's not based here?
Okay, that's actually a good question. Both laws originally called for application outside of the city. So if a worker lived in St. Louis Park and working in Minneapolis, but the company was based in St. Louis Park, they would be covered. But the Chamber of Commerce in the state sued, and the district court held that extraterritorial application was not valid. So right now, only companies that have a physical presence in both cities are affected by the sick leave laws.
Oh, okay. So, companies that have a physical presence in either Minneapolis or St. Paul.
That's correct.
Are covered. Okay. So even if you were, let's just say the delivery service was headquartered, or the beverage delivery service was headquartered in St. Louis Park, but they did have a warehouse that you worked out of in Minneapolis, would you be covered because the warehouse was in Minneapolis?
That's where it gets complicated. So the folks who are based out of the Minneapolis office and work in Minneapolis, and arguably the city St. Louis Park workers that come into the city too, would all be covered because of that Minneapolis warehouse. So that would draw the coverage for the work
okay.
done in the city.
So it's the physical presence.
That's correct.
Okay, and are both the St. Paul laws and the Minneapolis laws on leave, are they pretty much the same, and can you kind of summarize them?
Yeah, they are pretty similar. They each call for workers, pretty much every worker, to accrue 1 hour of paid leave for every 30 hours worked. There are very few exceptions to that. One of them would be construction workers who have the prevailing wage, for example. This applies to temporary and seasonal employees in both cities, so it's very broad. And accrual is capped at 48 hours per year. But basically, employees are going to accrue paid leave and be able to use that time. The difference is in St. Paul, unlike Minneapolis, it requires paid leave for all employees, whereas Minneapolis says employers who have 5 employees or less, they have to provide leave but doesn't have to be paid. And
okay.
St. Paul gave one short extension for smaller employees. Their effective date is actually not for 6 more months yet.
Okay. All right. So it's now, what if your company's sick leave policy is more generous than 6 days a year?
That's an excellent question. Employers in that situation should still pay attention because there's a whole lot more to these laws than just the time. The laws both say that is, if you provide more time than is required or the minimum required, you're good, but you still have to abide by the notice provisions, the record-keeping provisions, and all the host of other things, so the accrual schedule, for example. So you're not off the hook just because you might have a generous policy. You should still pay attention.
Oh, okay. And what is the reporting requirements?
Record keeping, I'm sorry, I may have said record keeping. Yeah, so the employers have to track how many hours employees are working and how much time they're accruing and how much time they've used. And that all has to go on a pay stub, and then probably it should go somewhere else too. And that way, if they're audited or if an employee brings forth a complaint, they can pull out their records and be able to defend themselves.
Okay. What about the law requiring, and does this affect maternity leave or paternity leave?
You would probably coordinate it with that, but it's not.
Those are separate.
Yes, they're separate.
Okay. Yep. Let me ask you, because as I understand it, the law, at least in Minneapolis, I don't know if this is also the case in St. Paul, allows you, if you don't use all your days, to kind of stockpile them. Is that right?
That's right. You can carry over up to 80 hours of leave each year. Employers can avoid that rollover requirement by front-loading the time each year, but that's got its own issues, too. So but there are options.
And so you can accrue, because I think the maximum leave you could get was 48 hours.
40 hours per year, but...
Yeah,
let's say I don't take any this year, and then I accrue my 48 the next year, then I would have, more, and then I can roll over my full 80.
Oh, but you can't accrue, because I actually do know people who have worked for, I want to say, with the post office. I know somebody who told me a story about how their father ended up retiring a year early because he had all this accrued sick leave or whatever. So you can't. So the maximum under the requirement is 48.
That you can accrue in 1 year, yes.
But under the law, if your office has a physical presence in Minneapolis or St. Paul, you can sort of stockpile up to 80 hours.
That's exactly right, yes.
Okay. Now, how does that work with the law starting now?
Actually, as of today, July 1, the laws are in effect for most employers. Like I said, St. Paul has that exception for smaller employers, and they're not coming online for another 6 months. But starting today, hours worked in each city with the physical presence result in 1 hour of accrual per every 30 hours worked. So hopefully most employers are ready to go. I suspect they're not based on the calls I've been receiving.
Oh, really? Okay.
But I think a lot of people have paid attention to this and are trying to get into compliance.
Well let me ask you, because, for example, for the people who work here, they don't, there's no accrual. We have eight sick days maximum. Many people don't take them all. I certainly don't. But does that mean I can accrue eight sick days starting January?
So your policy is they just give you 8 days? Is that what?
Right. And then it's gone. It's like, I usually use maybe two or three.
Okay. So they would have to allow you to roll over some of that time, up to 80 hours under the way the law works right now. So you shouldn't have it just disappear each year unless. Well, they are front-loading it. It sounds like they're front-loading it, right? I mean, you're getting a grant every year of the 8 days.
Right. They're starting January 1st through December 31st. You get and I think a lot of companies are like this, you get 8 sick days. Some people take all 8. Most people don't.
Well, that would not be compliant in the second year of the law, because a second year of law, if you choose the front-loading route, you have to provide up the full 80 hours. So that, unless you have 10-hour days at your company, which you might, eight days would not be sufficient, actually.
Oh, okay. So would the sick days from this year that you don't use roll over to next year?
Yes, they should.
Wow. Okay. Well.
Remember, if you front load, it doesn't have to roll over. So your company has chosen to front load, but they won't be in compliance when they don't front load enough the second year. It's complicated. I know.
Okay. I guess what happens to somebody like me if I don't use all my sick days?
So this year, if you don't use all your sick days and your company chooses next year to give you a fresh 8, nothing. Your time would disappear and your fresh 8 would show up on January 1.
Okay. And then what happens the next year? And
well, I don't next year they should give you 10 if they're going to choose the front loading to be in compliance with the law. Otherwise, they're short by 16 hours, I guess, would be the.
This is really complicated because I'm having trouble following you.
I know. I apologize. It's very complicated, and this is what, I spend time helping people get in compliance with this. So,
what is the biggest problem people are having?
I think a lot of people are assuming just because they provide enough that they're in compliance, but the questions that you just propose show that they might not be. You might be saying, hey, we're giving people plenty of time, but in the second year, you wouldn't be. So that big assumption that just...
Because they would have to, like, let's say nobody used any of their sick days this year, they'd still have to give you credit for next year, right?
They have to give you the fresh set next year, that's right. There's confusion still about coverage, which begs your earlier question. And that confusion is actually well-placed because the Minneapolis law is still under question in the courts. The Court of Appeals is going to hear the case in early July. So the challenge is still alive to the Minneapolis law.
Oh, okay. So the challenge, this is to the sick leave law.
That's correct. Yes. The Minneapolis sick leave law is still being challenged. And, you know, like I said, the district court held that it couldn't be applied extraterritorially. St. Paul voluntarily adopted that position. And now we'll have to wait and see what the Court of Appeals does. But I don't suspect that will come out for another three months, I guess, is about right.
Okay. And so the issue there is the issue of the physical presence?
There's three issues, actually. The chamber argued in the district court level that the law was preempted by state law and it was in conflict with state law, and argued that the extraterritorial application was not valid. The court did not agree with the preemption and the conflict arguments, but did say, yes, you can apply this law extraterritorially. All the parties appealed. So the city said, you're wrong on the extraterritorial application. The chamber said, you're wrong on the preemption and the conflict. And now it's up for the Court of Appeals to decide. And like I said, there's a hearing scheduled on July 11th, actually.
Wow. Okay. All right. Lisa Schmidt is an attorney with Nyland Johnson & Lewis. I bet you're getting a ton of calls here because it is really confusing.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time since this came out helping folks get in compliance. Absolutely.
Right. And what is the penalty if employers are not in compliance?
Well, in St. Paul, if you retaliate against someone, there's a civil action, so you could be sued and, you know, have to pay damages. But in Minneapolis, the city, and in both cities actually, the city human rights organizations will investigate claims, and they can make you pay back pay. They can make you reinstate a fired employee if you fired someone, and they can hit you with fines and penalties that go to the state. So
wow, okay,
yeah. So and the problem is you can be dinged for a lot of things under the laws, right? It's not just the failure to provide time. You screwed up record keeping, now you have to pay a fine.
And how about and for part time workers, they have to give you 1 hour for every 30 hours worked.
That's exactly right. So they'll accrue slower, but they still have to accrue. And that's where some businesses are screwing up, too. They kind of assume, I've seen a lot of policies come into my office that say part-time workers don't get any paid time off. Well, that's completely in violation. So they have to figure out how to start having them accrue, too.
And can they accrue if they are not used just the way that the full-time workers are?
Yeah, exactly. It should be exactly the same. It's just they'll accrue slower because of the hours worked.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. This
seasonal
is...
workers too, Esme. So it's every, like, if you're a big company and you hire, let's say, a whole bunch of people in the summer to do outside work, those people all accrue. So they may have eligibility if they last longer than 90 days, which is how long you have to wait to use it. They may have a bunch of sick leave that they could use.
Okay, so you got to work 90. So if you work like 3 or 4 weeks, that won't be it. Okay.
Correct. Yeah. So it's more like a half year type assignments would come into play there.
All right. Okay, Jonathan, I'm sorry. What is the question here?
We just had a listener question calling in, basically wondering about whether if there was an exemption for teachers and employees of schools, the school districts in both Minneapolis and St. Paul, for this, for what has been passed.
No, even though I imagine a lot of teachers are subject to collective bargaining agreements, both cities have made clear that even if you're subject to a contract like that, it does not exempt you from coverage, and it's true even if you're not. If teachers not subject to CBAs would also be covered. Interestingly, though, Minneapolis did allow people who have collective bargaining, companies that have collective bargaining agreements, an extra year to renegotiate those collective bargaining agreements to get into compliance. So that is one, you know, bone that was thrown to employers at least. But no, there's no exception for teachers.
Okay. All right. Well, it sounds like a lot of people are going to have to make some adjustments. Let me ask you, let's take a quick break because I do want to get into this issue of the $15 an hour wage, which was passed in Minneapolis, because that I'm sure has a lot of people wondering about things as well. So let's take a quick break. We'll have more with Lisa Schmidt. She's an attorney with Nyland Johnson & Lewis about all of these changes in terms of work rules and pay rules for Minneapolis and also for St. Paul. Your WCCO time check is 6:50, McCarthy Auto World, where you can save 20% off of MSRP on select Buick LaCrosses. Chatting here with Lisa Schmidt, an attorney for Nyland Johnson & Lewis, about all the workplace rule changes for Minneapolis and St. Paul. We want to get to that $15 wage that was just passed by the city council in Minneapolis, but we have another very good question from a listener. Lisa, a gentleman called in and spoke with Jonathan and says he works in Minneapolis and his employer does give him paid vacation, but does not give him paid sick leave. What does that mean?
That's an excellent question. Both St. Paul and Minneapolis's laws allow employers to take that kind of leave, paid PTO, vacation, other paid leave, and apply it to this. Those employers, though, would still have the notice obligation, so they would have to revise their handbook, for example, to say our vacation time counts toward the Minneapolis and/or St. Paul sick leave policy. So that's
okay.
They would have to do.
So that gentleman who just called, he might get 2 weeks paid vacation, but let's say he comes down with the flu, his employer could require him to take the 4 or 5 days he needs to take off to recover from the flu from his vacation.
Correct.
And he still would be able to. Would he still be able to carry stuff over? Or?
Yeah, if you're going to take your vacation or PTO and count it for the paid sick leave, you have to follow the other requirements. You have to accrue fast enough, so 1 for 30. You have to be allowed to carry some over, and you have to be allowed to use it for all the purposes that are covered in the law. So that is pretty broad. That would include, you know, your child's school is closed for weather, which is, as we all know, an issue in Minnesota, that they would have to be allowed to use it for the same purposes. So it narrows your focus on vacation, and you have to, follow these specific rules in regard to that.
Okay. All right. Well, let me ask you about the new rules with the wages. This is obviously
sure.
being phased in, and this is just for Minneapolis, and it is a little complicated about which the time differences for the phase-in. It depends on how many employees you have. Tell us about that.
Sure. So just this Friday, yesterday, I guess, Minneapolis adopted the $15 minimum wage ordinance. That does not mean the $15 an hour kicks in immediately. There's a schedule for both large and small employers, like you noted. Large employers generally have 100 employees, and small is the opposite, so smaller than 100 or smaller. The schedules for each is different. By July 2022, large employers will be at $15 an hour, and it'll take until 2024 for small employers to hit the $15 an hour wage. So, like I said, right. slower for the small folks.
And then the same question, what if you have the company that's based in St. Louis Park, and you've got the guy who does all his work in Minneapolis, maybe he works out of the warehouse here in Minneapolis?
Okay, so if there's a physical location in Minneapolis, for sure going to be covered. But unlike, this law took the same approach as Minneapolis sick leave and says all work in the city is covered as long as you hit the 2 hours a week minimum threshold. So I could be based in Duluth and send delivery drivers into Minneapolis to do routes. That work would be covered under this law. Now, I suspect it'll face a legal challenge just like the other law did. But for now, that's going to be covered, and large employers have to come into compliance as soon as January 1, 2018. So, really
wow, okay. So even if you are, and I'm sure that this probably involves a lot of people, let's say you are a delivery driver and your main routes are Minneapolis, or maybe it's Minneapolis and one suburb. Do you have to kind of track how many hours you're driving around Minneapolis?
You've called out the exact problem with this kind of law. Yes. I mean, this is an employer's nightmare, right? If I've got a guy who works every other day in Minneapolis for 4 hours here, 5 hours there, 6 hours there, that's going to be at a higher wage, and then the other hours are going to be the regular wage. And then let's say he works overtime. It complicates the overtime rate. It's really going to be a headache for employers that send folks into the city to work.
And in terms of, trying to do that, who's going to enforce this?
That's going to be the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights is going to be the agency that does that.
Okay. I bet you're getting calls on this one, too.
Yeah. We got calls and emails already yesterday and Friday. We sent out an update pretty quick. And, yes, there's people who are concerned. And the big issue, too, and you probably follow this as me, is that there's no tip credit in this law. And so for businesses that have tipped employees, there's quite a bit of outrage over that development.
Well, I know, and they're concerned that they're going to, that restaurants are going to close and that right. kind of thing. So there's an awful lot going on there. Well, listen, Lisa Schmidt, thank you so much for this information, because it does affect an awful lot of people.
Right. Yeah. It's not just Minneapolis. I've been telling my clients that it's not this minimum wage, especially, is not just Minneapolis. And the paid sick leave could come back on board for everybody, too, depending on how that court decision comes down in the fall. So
right. And you're expecting that in the fall. And that, the main issue, again, is the physical presence, right?
That, and I guess the court could say the chamber's right altogether and the law is just preempted by state law, and then the law will go away. So this would be an exercise in futility for all of us. But
okay.
I suspect that won't happen. That's my
okay.
gut.
All right. Well, listen, thank you so much. Really very informative, and obviously a lot of people kind of wondering exactly how this affects them.
Yeah.
I appreciate that, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the time.
All right, folks. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. Much more ahead. We are going to listen to an expert on Minnesota rodeo coming up in the next hour. Keep it here, News Radio.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together, we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.